ball. Before turning in myself, I'd lay out Joan's clothes and prepare her lunch for the next day. Such was my life's tempo until the year Joan was 9. The year when my dear aunt craved a respite, and I, reluctant yet clear that I needed consistent childcare, returned to Mom's place and purview. I truly did not want to move back in with my mother. And yet the Heavenly Father, in his omniscience, obviously saw fit to keep drawing us together, perhaps because he knew I had some spiritual business to complete. When you ask God for strength, as I do daily, he doesn't usually just drop it from the sky. He often answers by placing you in a circumstance that requires you to build fortitude while relying solely on him. Motherhood had thrust me into adulthood prematurely, and yet emotionally, even by my late 20s, I was still a child in some ways, still a girl guided by the rise and fall of my mother's brow, by her approval and displeasure. While living with my aunt, I towered in my sense of autonomy, wrapped myself tight in the cloak of my position as an independent parent. But back in my mother's apartment, I found myself regressing into the voicelessness of my earliest years, cowering beneath the reign of the woman who'd always steered me. By voiceless, I do not mean mute. I bickered weakly with my mother, railed against her rule more than I dared to during childhood. I see now that I wasn't fighting against her, but for myself. Defying her voice was my way of making space for my own, however feeble and uncertain. At the heart of our disputes lived my struggle for womanhood, my yearning to trust God's whispers and tune out all others. A year after I'd been with my mother, the father's whisper crescendoed into a shout. After work late one evening, I returned home to find Joan out on the street in front of the apartment, hopscotching with another girl from the block. I peered around. On one shadowy corner sat a row of old men, slamming down dominoes on a fold-up table and swigging beer. Across from there, a group of women balanced themselves on crates, cackling and carrying on as a radio blared. I then looked up. There, near the top floor of our building, my mother sat on the ledge of her apartment's windowsill, gazing down at the scene. I glanced at my watch. 10 p.m. What on earth is my child still doing up? I approached Joan, who skipped over into my arms when she spotted me. "What are you doing out here at this hour?" I asked her. She smiled. "Playing," she said, oblivious to the worry on my face. "Do you know what time it is?" I said. "You have to go to school in the morning." Upstairs, my mother had no reasonable explanation for why she'd allowed Joan to linger in the streets. "Mom, why is this baby outdoors so late?" I asked, my voice rising by the syllable. She shrugged. "Don't come in here fussing," she snapped. "I had my eye on that girl all evening. I could see her from where I was sitting." Joan was 10 at the time. When I was that age, the earth would have had to topple off its axis for my mother to allow me outdoors after dark. What was she thinking? I did not know. The one reason I conjured had to do with my tense dynamic with Mom since I'd returned to live with her. Our disputes were vociferous and constant. In fact, that very week, we'd had a doozy of a quarrel. I cannot recall what triggered the clash, probably because it wounded me so. Our strife must be spilling over into her treatment of Joan, I thought. Or maybe, after raising her own 3 children, Mom had understandably grown weary with caretaking. Whatever had prompted her strange behavior, I knew our arrangement had to end. I did not discuss this with my mother, nor did I ask for her opinion. I simply made a grown-up decision, one markedly absent of her input. I would secure my baby's care. I didn't know how I would do so, but I was convinced that I must. The next morning, I began researching boarding schools. With the 50 and 60-hour work weeks I was clocking, I knew I could not be there for my daughter in the way that I wanted, the way countless working mothers long to be. And yet, if I was going to partner with others in caring for Joan, I had to be sure I could trust the palms I placed her in. When you don't know what to do, you do what you know. And all of my life, I'd been taught to trust those guided by the same God who led me. That is why, when my eyes fell on an advertisement for a Christian boarding school in upstate New York, I immediately became interested. Upon calling, I learned that the school was run by a minister and his wife, a couple who once had presided over a church in Harlem. The next week, I traveled to meet the couple. I toured the middle school campus, talked with some of the teachers and students, and inspected the all-girl dormitories. My spirit said yes. But you can never be too careful when it comes to your child, your treasure, which is why, weeks later, I visited again, to be sure all was in order. I returned home carrying both a greater sense of certainty that this was the right place for Joan, and a financial arrangement with the school that put the cost within reach for me. When I revealed my plan to my mother, with nary a stutter as I spoke, she of course protested. "Why are you taking that child up there?" she pressed. I stared at her, but felt no urge to explain, no desire to reveal how her behavior had prompted my choice. I knew what I had to do, and nothing she could say would unbutton my resolve. I would stay on with my mother and continue working in the city, I told her, but Joan's care could not be compromised. That was that. In the fall of 1953, at the start of my daughter's fifth grade year, I packed her belongings and took the train with her upstate. Joan was more excited than hesitant about her adventure. But that changed the farther north we rode. An hour into our journey, she folded her palm into mine and leaned into my shoulder. "Mommy, why can't you come with me?" she asked. I squeezed her hand. "Sweetie," I whispered, "I promise I will visit you as often as I can, but Mommy has to work." "How do you explain to your daughter, the center of your existence, why you must separate from her? How do you tell a child, one you love to the stars and beyond, that a long stretch of sunrises will live between you?" "You don't." In place of clarifying, you weep inside, your lips trembling as towns and pine trees and colors blur by your train car window. You wish it did not have to be, this distance between your worlds. You cringe as you hear your baby's plea and grip her hand more tightly. And yet you know. You know with the same immutable assurance that rose up in me on the day I walked away from my marriage. By all outward appearances, there was a decision to be made, a lever to be pulled, stay or go. But inwardly, the only true choice for me was onward. I understood that to my core, knew it with the same certainty I'd once known our neighbor's apartment would go up in flames, knew it as surely as I know there is a creator. And yet the truth, however irrefutable it is, does not spare its pursuer the accompanying anguish. On that fall afternoon when I waved goodbye to my child, the red-orange leaves above us lowering their heads in lament, every part of me ached. I kept my promise to visit frequently. In the following months, I traveled north any time I could yank my fingers away from my typewriter. I also brought Joan home for spring break and holidays, and sometimes on weekends. I missed her as much as I knew I would, multiplied by far more than that. Whenever Joan was in the city with me, I whisked my angel around town, loading up shopping bags with more dresses and shoes and coats than my checking account could bear. Our eventual partings, our eyelids brimming with sadness and adoration, were no less excruciating than the first had been. That year of long division flowed seamlessly into 1954, the year I turned 30 and was still living with my mother, still finding my way. That's when God cleared his voice and again spoke. His message, undeniable in its clarity, penetrating in its delivery, came in several spine-tingling installments. 9. Shoulder taps. Show me a West Indian woman, and I'll show you an enterpriser holding down three jobs. Years before the arts swept me up in its gale winds, I strung together a living by adding multiple side gigs to my main one. I wielded my hot comb all over the five boroughs, leaving a trail of charred scalps in my wake. After my primary job at the law firm was finished each day, I staggered over to my second gig, what was then known as a typing pool, a group of work-for-hire secretaries who transcribed shorthand notes for male executives who did not have their own administrative staffs. I worked nights. Typing pools were not for the feeble. In a cavernous warehouse space, row after row of ambitious young women, with their tie-neck blouses and ruler straight postures, swiftly churned out documents on mammoth imperial typewriters. Just to break into most pools, you had to accurately type 80 words per minute. Repeated mistakes, which cost the employer both time and paper in a world still absent of correction fluid, could get you dismissed. I can still feel the brush of my fingertips against the cold steel keys, can hear the cacophony of taps and dings wafting to the ceiling. I'd thankfully mastered both stenography and shorthand in high school, and by graduation, I could deliver pristine copy at 100 words per minute. Aside from that graveyard shift, I rounded up scores of other jobs over the years. One summer, I worked as a transcriptionist for Save the Children. The next, I took a spot on the assembly line of a nail factory. Toward the end of the war, I was hired as a secretary inside the Navy Purchasing Office, a sprawling edifice at 90 Church Street. That job put a spring in my father's gait. After you finish high school, Dad would often tell me when I was a youngster, I want you to go to work in one of those tall buildings downtown. Mind you, he did not care what position I held. My mere presence in a soaring structure, one representing upward mobility, was accomplishment enough for him. In his mind, earning a living in a skyscraper where few blacks were ever spotted meant I'd made it, that his offspring had fared better than he could have when he arrived in America, empty-handed and hopeful. On the day I landed the job, I called him. Well, Dad, I said, you got your wish. I'm in one of those tall buildings downtown. That week, he took the number 6 train south to see it for himself. Arm in arm, the two of us stood together on the sidewalk, gazing up in awe. He looked over at me, then skyward again, and then back at me. Congratulations, String Bean, he said, planting a kiss on my cheek as he beamed. The year Joan went to boarding school, I renewed my search for temporary gigs I could fit around my position at the law firm. In those days, everyone at the employment office of the Urban League in Harlem knew me by name. I was in that office more than I was in my mother's apartment. One afternoon, I pranced in, my short hair freshly pressed and precisely styled. Audrey Hepburn, with her pixie cut and her delicate pearl earrings was the golden girl to mimic in that era. And my family, noting my take on the icon's cut, began calling me the Black Audrey. Even strangers would often proclaim, "Oh, you look just like Audrey Hepburn." Not quite, but I embraced the compliment. "What kind of position are you looking for?" asked a young woman I hadn't yet met. "Anything," I said. "How fast can you type?" she asked. "Over 100 words a minute," I said. She nodded approvingly, picked up the receiver on her phone, and dialed one of her contacts. Afterward, she scribbled something on a sheet of paper and handed it to me. "Go here," she said. I eyed 3 words at the top of the paper, American Red Cross, with the address in Midtown near 38th and Lexington, scrawled beneath. That afternoon, I was hired as a fill-in secretary to the vice president, Ms. Rubin. The part-time position, which involved typing case histories for the organization, eventually morphed into full-time work. It also became the vehicle for God's strong tap on my shoulder. It was 1954. I'd been at the Red Cross for about a year when Ms. Johnson, a sweet, older black woman who sat 3 feet from me in the office, retired. She'd spent most of her career at the company, hunched over a typewriter, producing hundreds of case histories. A farewell party was organized, complete with a sheet cake and well wishes from those who'd worked with her. Ms. Johnson's longtime supervisor gave a sentimental speech about how much she loved this woman, how noble her service had been over many decades. As she closed, dabbing at her eyes with a white hanky, she presented Ms. Johnson with a parting gift, a gold wristwatch. Everyone around me clapped. I did not. I stood there feeling dumbfounded, observing all the tears and grins and applause, while a thought gripped me. A watch? You mean she spent nearly all her adult life in this place, and all she gets is a measly watch? It seemed absolutely pitiful to me. It also seemed like an opinion best kept to myself. Which is why, later that afternoon when my perspective came sputtering forth, it stunned me. As Ms. Johnson said her final goodbyes around the office, the rest of us clerks settled back at our typewriters, eyeing the wall clock to calculate the number of click-clacks till quitting time. That's when, seemingly out of nowhere, a proclamation tumbled out of my mouth. "I'll tell you one thing," I said loudly enough for everyone to hear. "I'm not gonna be any place for no 30 years until somebody hands me a wristwatch and says thank you very much. I'll buy myself a watch." Silence. If a strand of my hair had fallen to the carpet, you would have heard it. That's how quiet that room got. 2 of my co-workers glanced over at me, and another giggled nervously, peering around to see whether our boss had heard me. The girl closest to me stared at me like I'd plumb lost it. In a sense, I suppose I had. As life has taught me time and again, you often have to lose your present circumstance to make room for your forthcoming one. A moment later, I went back to typing, even as the sentiment lingered. "I'm never going to be in Ms. Johnson's position," I said to myself. "Not me." Some might call it a thought, or perhaps a quiet resolve. I firmly believe it was the voice of God, presenting itself in the form of my own instinct. Leading up to that declaration, God had already planted a seed. For months, I'd been feeling an increasing sense of dissatisfaction, an uneasiness born of the query buried in the bosom of all humanity. Is this all there is? That question had been gnawing at me for quite some time. The party and the gift to Ms. Johnson simply prompted its expression. To be clear, there is nothing disgraceful about how this woman had chosen to spend her working years. For all I knew, Ms. Johnson had fulfilled her grand vision for herself in a perfectly honorable pursuit. When she'd entered the workforce in the 1920s, this sister would have been considered quite fortunate to have office work, never mind a job steady enough to sustain her through the Depression and beyond. And yet I had a powerful sense that my journey would be less stationary and more adventure-filled, that it would wind and bob its way through a landscape devoid of stenopads and number two pencils. I couldn't imagine spending decades at a desk, all for someone to congratulate me in the end with a watch from a department store. My life, my service, my time, they were worth far more to me than $100 timepiece. Not long after, that feeling intensified. I was given a new case history to transcribe, one involving a young black wife and mother. In her consultation with my supervisor, the woman confided that her husband was having sex with their 8-year-old daughter. When I got to that line, I stopped typing and picked up the paper, rereading and praying I'd seen it wrong. I hadn't. "Why didn't you report him?" Ms. Rubin had asked the mother. Her answer still sends a shiver through me. "I was afraid he would lose his job," she had said. I'll tell you, I was no good for the rest of that week. "Your child is being molested by her father, and you won't go to the authorities because you're scared he'll be fired?" It sickened me to my core. It also served as a painful reminder of what it meant, and still often means, to be black in this country. So precarious has our financial position been that too many of us have been forced to choose between economic security and safety for our children. Even now, all these years later, recalling that transcript makes me want to retch. No way could I, year after year, bear witness to such agony, memorializing heartache with ink-stained iron keystrokes. After typing up the full case that afternoon, I pushed myself back from the desk and made another major proclamation. I am sure God didn't put me on the face of this earth to bang on a typewriter for the rest of my life, I said. There is something else for me to do. I don't know what it is, but I will find it. From my lips to God's ears, or as I see it now, the other way around. The next week, I received another love note from heaven. During my lunchtime, I shot out of the office and headed straight for nearby Lord & Taylor. Oh, how I loved that department store. During the holidays, its windows along Fifth Avenue featured the most breathtaking Christmas displays, lavish and sparkling, casting a spell and glow over the entire block. Admirers traveled from all parts of the globe just to stand before those windows in all their twinkling glory. I frankly had little business in a store, given what I earned, but that never stopped me from roaming the aisles, dreaming about a new pocketbook or a scarf for Joan. It broke my heart when decades later in 2019, the store closed its doors after a century in business. Anyway, on that day, I flounced out to shop, feeling attractive in my wraparound pinstripe dress and patent leather pumps, eager for my midday routine. What happened next was anything but. Just as I was rounding the corner onto Fifth Avenue, a black man decked out in a business suit and a scarlet bow tie tapped me on the shoulder. I swiveled around. "Excuse me, miss," he said. "Are you a model?" "No," I said, searching his face for where this was going. "Well, if you aren't," he said, "you should be." I blushed, not sure how to respond. I never saw myself as beautiful. My first crush, Horace, had convinced me I was somewhat cute, at least in his eyes. But beyond that, I thought I was plain. When it came to appearance, what I felt certain about was my ability to dress, thanks to the elite fashion education afforded to me by my parents known in our church as Mr. and Mrs. Beau Brummel. Stylish? Yes, darling. And please pass me my mink stole. Slender? Absolutely. But beautiful? That label did not live at the heart of my self-identity. In the view of whites in this country, one's blackness, characterized by the tiniest drop of melanin or the faintest trace of a negroid feature, has historically nullified one's gorgeousness. And yet despite that, others always seemed to be telling me I was pretty, particularly in my 20s as I grew out of my lankiness and into my face and figure. So when this stranger stopped me on the street, the surprise wasn't just that he thought I was attractive, it was that he nudged me toward a universe that was foreign to me. "How do you go about becoming a model?" I asked him. "You connect with an agent and you go to modeling school," he explained. "Once you've finished your training, the agent sends you out on interviews for jobs." He paused and looked me up and down, as if to be sure his original assessment had been accurate. "You really should give it a shot," he said. I smiled, politely thanked him, and went on about my way to the store. I initially disregarded the stranger's comments. Me? A model? The idea seemed outlandish, given that I was almost 30 years old and presumably well past a model's prime time. And yet our conversation curled up in my spirit, the way certain notions do when they're set on residing permanently. And right alongside that, was the feeling I'd been grappling with. The sense that my work as a secretary was not the end of the career road for me, but rather a milestone along an alternate route. So acute was this feeling that 1 week after that businessman stopped me on the sidewalk, I pulled out the yellow pages. I flipped to the section labeled Modeling Schools and scanned the list of agencies. All of them, based on the names and locations, seemed headed by white folks. "They're not gonna take me for no modeling job anyhow," I thought. I slammed the book shut. Yet I continued to ponder the idea, and even mentioned it to my longtime friend, Thelma Jack. The two of us had met years earlier during our young teens at a summer camp upstate. Thelma's face lit up when I told her what the man had proposed. "You know, there's a woman in Harlem who runs a modeling school," she told me. "Her name is Barbara Watson. She's the daughter of Judge Watson," as in James S. Watson, the first black judge elected in New York City, and husband to Violet Lopez Watson, a founding member, along with Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, of the National Council of Negro Women. In 1946, Barbara May Watson, the eldest of four, founded the first agency for African-American models. Emboldened by my friend's encouragement and armed with this fresh data, I called the school. Ms. Watson herself answered. I stammered my way through a conversation, and she saved me from my bluster with a concluding request. "Why don't you come in for an interview?" I got right to work on preparing. I may have known nothing about a catwalk, but I was confident I could put on a fashion show, one I prayed would impress this well-spoken, Barnard-educated lady who'd been gracious enough to invite me in. My favorite color was light blue, and my closet teemed with the hue. Blue tea-length hoop skirts, blue pocketbooks, blue everything. Years later, I grew into purple, but it never stole blue's spotlight. "Don't you know any other color?" my mother would ask me. I never wearied of its soothing quality, its ability to transport me to a wide sky, cloud-dappled tranquility. So for my inaugural meeting with Ms. Watson, I, of course, fished out my finest powder blue cotton dress, one gathered at the waist with a row of glistening gold buttons stretching down its left side. I completed the look with black suede pumps and silk thigh-high stockings minus garters. Like many working-class West Indian women, I secured each stocking with a top knot, tight enough to cut off one circulation. I was blessed to even have silk nylons. During the war, silk and other commodities had run in short supply, and as a result, nylon repair shops sprang up. My spot was a little cleaner's in a basement around the corner from the Red Cross. Before my interview, I took my nylons there, and child, once they fixed my two runs for 5 cents each, those stockings looked brand new. People then took such pride in their workmanship. On the day I stepped my suede toe over Ms. Watson's threshold, I strutted in like I was working a Paris runway. She scanned my outfit, smiled, and offered me a seat. "So have you done any modeling at all, Miss Cicely?" she asked. "No, ma'am, I have not," I said, carefully pronouncing each word. "I see," she said. She then asked me a few questions about my background, as well as how I'd learned about the agency. I gave her the short story as she jotted down notes on an intake form. "Well," she finally said, leaning back in her seat and laying down her pen, "what would you think about having some photos taken?" I nodded. "Yes, miss," I said, trying to contain my glee. "Excellent," she said, standing up to show me out to the lobby. "And in the meantime, I hope you'll sign up for our course." Nearly before she'd completed that sentence, I'd enrolled. The evening course, which included about 25 women, spanned several weeks. Ms. Watson taught us the fundamentals of charm and poise, how to perfect our postures, how to hold our bodies as we glided across a room with effortlessly supple movement, how to pose for photographers, how to pivot and curtsy and smile. At 5 feet 4 inches tall, I wasn't runway material, so I kept my ears widest for the catalog and magazine model training. Meanwhile, I began work on my portfolio. I arranged for a photographer to take 3 images of me: a headshot in a navy suit, a body shot in a baby blue dress, and a swimsuit shot in a teal 2-piece suit. The latter was quite modest, nothing like today's dental floss bikinis that leave one's derriere hanging out. If I'd been required to don such a suit, this church girl would have ended her modeling career before it began. But I was comfortable in my portfolio bikini, one cut just below the navel, and one just like those I wore to the beach. Once I'd received the photos, I scheduled a session with Ms. Watson to show her the spread. Her business partner Mildred Smith, who also served as an editor at Our World magazine, a lifestyle publication catering to Black women, attended the meeting. The two looked through my photos, closely studying each. Neither said a word. "Can you please give us a few moments to speak?" Ms. Watson finally said. "Yes, of course," I said, my heart hammering away in my chest. The women then stepped off to the side and out of my earshot, likely so they could decide how to run me out of that office, I feared. After what felt like hours, but was probably 3 minutes, they turned to me. "So how many copies did you have made of each of these photos?" Ms. Watson asked. "Well, I didn't know what you would expect," I said, "so I just got a few." "Well," she said, "we'd like to order a few hundred more on your behalf." I gulped. "Really?" I said, my eyes widening. "Yes, really," she said, smiling. While I'd decided I was about to be banished from modeling schools the world over, the women had been discussing my strategic launch, how to saturate the market with my photos. In my class of potential models, only 2 were ultimately chosen. I, daughter of a housekeeper, child of the Most High, was astoundingly one of them. I did not resign from the Red Cross, at least not right away. In the early days of my new modeling career, I had no reason to believe this little venture of mine would be anything more than a leisure pursuit. A hobby wouldn't pay Joan's tuition. Still, I poured my soul into the project. Ms. Watson, of course, rounded up opportunities for me. And I, rather than hightailing it to Lord and Taylor at noon, scoured the avenues of the city, turning up cold at magazines and women's catalog companies and offering my portfolio. Every one of us bears the wounds and characteristics our parents unwittingly pass on to us, and likewise, we receive their most admirable tendencies. Willie and Frederica, bare-knuckled and unremitting, handed their work ethic to me. I booked a few catalog gigs immediately, bolstering my excitement that modeling might be my ticket out of a years-long sentence as a secretary. The jobs were small, but I loved the work, just loved it. The posing and the grinning, the rapid-fire click-click-click of the camera, and, of course, the bottomless well of beautiful clothing. I suppose to be truly successful at any pursuit, you have to fall in love with it, surrender to its gravitational pull, allow it to carry you off to that world of giddy sleeplessness. Speaking of shut-eye, I got little. I pecked my way 9 to 5 on weekdays through my work at the Red Cross before making my evening rounds with portfolios spilling from my satchel. Then after my 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift in the secretarial sweatshop 2 nights a week, I dashed home with just enough time to shower, brush my teeth, and limp back out the door. From the start, I viewed modeling for what it was, a business, an income generator. The fact that I saw it as such is why the bashfulness of my youth naturally fell away. Because believe me, I have never been shy about making money. The most potent antidote to reticence is survival. The gigs at first trickled in, and then flooded. In the beginning, I modeled anything and everything, shoes and handbags, and hats and swimsuits, and even wigs for local hair salons. Those entry-level jobs put me on the map in the modeling community, and before long, I was landing covers and spreads for major magazines such as Ebony, Jet, and of course, the publication where Ms. Mildred Smith worked, Our World. It was there one afternoon in early 1955 when God breathed in my direction yet again. On my way out of a meeting with Ms. Smith, I spotted a woman in the waiting room. As I passed, she gave me the once-over, and I, thinking nothing of it, nodded courteously and hurried back to the Red Cross. I didn't know it at the time, but that woman happened to be Evelyn Davis, an actress. When Evelyn went in to see Ms. Smith, she asked her, "Who was that young lady who sashayed out of here?" "She's a model working with Barbara Watson," she said. "Why do you ask?" "Because I just came from an interview for a movie," she said, "and they are looking for a young lady who looks just like her to play the lead." I hadn't been back at my work desk for more than 3 minutes when the phone rang. "I think I got you a movie," said Miss Smith, hardly breathing between each word. "A movie?" I said. "What are you talking about, a movie?" She explained what Evelyn had mentioned and then concluded with, "And can you believe you look just like the young lady they're looking for? Evelyn can arrange for you to meet the director." I paused and glanced around, concerned that my supervisor would overhear me on the phone. "Listen," I said, "I don't know anything about making no movie, and I'm not going any place to make a fool of myself." Click. I'd been to see one film during my lifetime, and as you know, the experience scared the spit out of me. A movie? No way was I going to get involved with the film business. But God clearly saw it another way, and he sent Ms. Smith to deliver his opposing viewpoint. The next morning, she called me again, begging me to reconsider. Why don't you just go over and meet the director? She kept saying. I declined. Finally, after she rang me 3 days in a row, I almost burst a blood vessel. Look, do me a favor, I said, trying and failing to whisper. You're going to make me lose my job. Please, don't call me anymore. Then tell me that you'll go see this man after you get off work today, she urged. Yes, 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 I said, rushing her off the phone. Just as I was about to click down the receiver, she said, but wait, you don't know where I'm sending you. Well, then you'd better talk fast, I told her. She gave me the address, an office down in Carnegie Hall. The director's name was Warren Coleman. I wasn't at all nervous to meet Mr. Coleman, whom I eventually came to call Warren. I had no expectations, and therefore no stakes, other than to get Ms. Smith off my back. I sat there, relaxed as could be, while Warren, with his velvety smooth voice and easy smile, led me on a tour of his professional ascent. As one of theater's most gifted operatic baritones, Warren had created and played the roles of Crown in Gershwin's Porgy and Bess and John Cumulo in Kurt Weill's Lost in the Stars. He became a Broadway fixture throughout the 1930s and 1940s, which was long enough for him to recognize how black artists were mistreated, how our creative brilliance was overshadowed by our social rank, how the same white audience members who applauded black performers publicly wouldn't allow them to scoot up to their private dinner tables. Those realities had prompted him to form his own production company and create films reflecting African-American life in all of its resplendent intricacy. He was just beginning work on his first independent movie, The Spectrum, a film about color consciousness in the black community. As he spoke, I feigned interest, nodding at the appropriate junctures, the whole time thinking, this is nonsense. I am not going to be any actress. How much do you know about acting? Warren asked me. Nothing at all, I said. Well, I have the script of the film right here, he said. He rummaged through a stack of papers and notebooks on his desk and handed me a spiral-bound book. Why don't you take this home and read it? I flipped through it just to be polite. I've never done anything like this, sir, I told him. I just don't think I'm the right one, but I appreciate your time. I then sat the book on the desk, picked up my pocketbook, and walked toward the door. No, wait a minute. Wait, he said, retrieving the script and following me toward the entrance. I really want you to take this script with you. Can you just read it and see what you think? Will you do that? I looked back at him. I suppose, I said, thinking, what harm could come of it? I guess I could have a look. Excellent, he said, giving me the book. I'll give you a call in a couple weeks. I carried the script home and tossed it into my bedside drawer. I prefer my humiliation private, thank you very much. And as ambitious as I was to earn money, I had no interest in making a public spectacle of myself. I promptly forgot about the script until a couple of days later, when I was searching in that drawer for a hairbrush, my eyes fell on the book's cover. I pulled it out and read the first page. An hour later, I was still reading. The story gripped me. Autumn, the female lead and a blossoming writer, came to New York with aspiration in her eyes, hoping to sell an article she'd penned. She was my dark complexion. The magazine editor she approached was light-skinned, as was the man she eventually fell in love with. The two began a courtship, and the man's mother, determined that her son maintain the privilege of their honey-tinged heritage, protested mightily. If you marry her, she warned him, you'll destroy your career. I found the plot captivating, yet I still could not see myself in it, especially as the lead. If Warren succeeded in making the film, I told myself, I'd be the first to line up at the cinema to see who played in it and what this whole acting thing was about. And yet, much as I had no vision of myself as Autumn, my curiosity had been awakened. Another shoulder tap, another whisper from on high. At 2 weeks to the day, Warren rang me. "I'd like you to come to the studio and meet someone," he said. I agreed. When I arrived, he introduced me to an actor by the name of Hal DeWint, who was to play the male lead in The Spectrum. "So what did you think of the script?" Warren asked me with hope in his voice. "I think it's great reading," I said, chuckling. "I enjoyed the story very much." "Good," he said. He looked over at Hal and then back at me. "I'd like the two of you to read a scene together," he said. "Cecily, you read Autumn, and Hal will read his part." I paused, slowly reached into my bag, and pulled out the script. The reading flowed seamlessly. Our voices fit together naturally, weaving and swaying in step as if we'd been rehearsing with one another for weeks. Magic operates as such. When a pivot is predestined on the stone tablet of your life story, there is often an inexplicable ease to it. It feels otherworldly, from an almighty source beyond your frail humanity. That is how reading that scene felt to me, supernatural. When I completed my final lines and looked up, Warren was staring at me and grinning. "So do you want to be an actress, Cecily?" he said. "Seems to me you already are." I lowered the script and looked down at the floor, giving doubt a chance to resurface. "I don't know anything about making a movie," I told him. "Well," he said, laughing and sidestepping my reluctance, "I guess you'll find out." Warren asked whether he could call me again. The part of my spirit that understood the moment's transcendence, the power of the precipice I was dancing along, agreed. Even when we humans are busy shaking our heads no, shoving down our fears and shoving off our blessings, the Father has a way of propelling us forward, of moving us toward his way. Warren indeed called and pleaded with me to play Autumn, only to be met with another round of my misgivings. And just as Miss Smith had, he called a second time, refusing to be shunned. By his third call, I'd finally aligned my will with the Father's. I told Warren yes. And he not only persuaded me to play the role, he insisted that he manage me. "How old are you?" he asked me early on. 30, I told him. He gazed at me incredulously. "Really?" he said. I nodded. "Well, you certainly don't look it," he said. "You could pass for 10 years younger, my dear, and from now on, you should claim to be." Nature has bestowed black people with one of its most prized gifts, melanin, and in a society where we are seldom allowed an advantage, Warren understood the importance of utilizing mine. 6 decades would go by before I let the public in on what was frankly never any of their business. By the time I agreed to portray Autumn, filming had paused. Warren was leaving shoot tracks all over Manhattan, trying to raise the necessary capital to complete the production. That didn't stop Hal and me. We began rehearsing during my lunch breaks, as well as any time I could wedge a session into the cracks of my packed schedule. As we practiced our scenes, gone was the apprehension I'd felt about acting, and in its place was the passion that had powered my rise as a model. I may initially waver before lunging toward a new experience, but once I do, I grow unrelenting. I rehearsed my lines with the frenzy of a capsized sailor, gasping for air, desperate to stay afloat. And even while Hal and I worked, Warren began sending me out on small auditions. I mostly floundered, but that didn't matter, because at least I was in the room. One failed audition at a time, I was learning the business, dipping my toe in its frigid waters. It was Warren who introduced me to the flurry and bustle of New York theater, and in many ways, to life beyond the walls of the church world I'd been reared in. Given his long-standing success on Broadway, he had access, which he leveraged to offer me a crash course in both craft and sophistication. I became fast friends with the affable Diana Sands, another young actress in the spectrum, and Warren whisked us from one play and concert to the next, where we met performers backstage, soaking in the chaos and the costumes and the color of their behind-the-curtain artistry and antics. Afterward, he exposed us to some of the city's finest cuisines. In the rice and plantains existence of my youth, escargot had absolutely no place. Into the wee hours of the morning over such purported delicacies, we'd talk scripting and technique and plot. I had no idea what I was gibbering about, of course, but Warren insisted I had potential. "You've got natural talent," he assured me. I'd smile and think, "What does that even mean?" A raw slab of marble also has so-called potential, but only when a sculptor chips away at it piece by piece does a face emerge. Raw talent does not a fine actor make. Which is why, even as I zealously rehearsed with Hal, I prioritized my modeling work. Before I knew it, I was earning enough money to finally leave the Red Cross, 3 decades shy of a gilded watch, and feeling grateful for the stepping stone that job served for me. From the start, I'd told my mother about my modeling work, and surprisingly, she voiced no objections, especially after she began spotting me in the center spreads of the magazines she read. She soaked it up. She had a famous daughter, child, one with accomplishments worth displaying, one she could now be proud of again after a season of a lowered head. My work qualified not as an ungodly undertaking, but as a point of family and community pride. But the same could not be said of her perspective on my film work, which I hid from her. One night, Warren asked me, "Have you told your mother about the movie?" I shook my head. "She would not approve," I said. "Well, maybe I should talk to her," he offered. "That's not a good idea," I shot back. "I would rather her not know right now." My work on the spectrum was easy to conceal. Mom was used to my coming and going at all times of the day and night, so that did not raise suspicion. But things changed soon after my conversation with Warren. Late one evening, after Warren and I had seen a mesmerizing production of My Fair Lady at the Mark Hellinger Theater, he walked me home. My mother happened to be sitting at her window, looking down and watching the world go by, like the old folks often do. She spotted Warren and me. When I got upstairs to the apartment, the grand inquisition commenced. "Who was that man you were with?" she asked me. "He's a producer, Mom," I said. "He's doing a movie, and he would like me to be a part of it." I stopped short of revealing I'd been rehearsing for months. "You can't do that," she told me. "Why?" I said. "You're going to leave this good job you have for this damn foolishness?" she said, referring to my typing pool and modeling work. "I didn't say I was leaving anything," I retorted. "I just said I was going to go do this movie." She stared at me for a long moment. "Well, you can't stay here and do that," she said. Her statement jarred me so, echoed through me, that I could not even look at her. Without a word, I rose from the couch and disappeared into my bedroom. There was no sense in arguing with my mother. What she was forbidding me to do, I was already headlong into doing, with no intention of reversing course. God himself had pointed my suede pumps in this new direction. I'd come to believe that, even as I was still making sense of the film industry and wondering whether I had any place in it. And while I'd known instinctively this disagreement with my mother had been postponable, I'd also realized it was inevitable. I'd dared to enter the den of iniquity, Lucifer's workshop as my mom saw it. Anything to do with entertainment or theater was pure sin, the devil's territory, an express train to Hades. My apparent transgression, as well as the temerity I'd shown in mentioning it within my mother's earshot, was grounds enough for her to promptly dismiss me. The next day, I called Thelma Jack. She was working for the telephone company and had her own place downtown at 112 East 7th Street. It had two bedrooms. "May I come live with you?" I asked her after explaining my situation. She enthusiastically agreed, eager not only to share her apartment, but also to have the rent. I'd have my own private space there, one large enough to have Joan with me during her school breaks. Another upside that made Thelma the consummate roommate candidate. She and I wore the same dress size, a 4. That was important to me, because in between rehearsing and modeling, I was still constantly interviewing for clerical temp jobs. When I'd go out on interviews, I could borrow Thelma's dresses, and borrow I did. When I left my mother's apartment, we did not speak for nearly a year. We did not see each other for almost 2. As devastated as I was by her choice, as deeply as her words had sliced through me, I knew she'd made the only decision she felt she could. It was her way of loving me, of trying to redirect my steps and shift my affections away from the strivings of this world and back toward the kingdom of heaven. And yet even those who care deeply for us cannot always see our big picture, the grand storyline that is destined to unfold before us. They are on their own journeys, and though their paths may run parallel to ours, each is singular in its curves and mileposts, unique in its destination. As much as others want the best for us, they do not necessarily understand God's best. He alone does. My liberation from my mother's rule created in me a newfound fervor. Mom had hoped to douse my burgeoning dream with her condemnation, prayed she could snuff it out with a stinging decree. But she'd inadvertently lit a match beneath me. Up to then, enamored though I was with the notion of acting, I was still secretly grappling with my fears, my uncertainties about whether I'd ever be good enough for the stage. My mother's disapproval became my liquid fuel, my requisite source of strength. Before she put me out, I'd been attempting to prove to myself that I could excel as an actress. Afterward, her displeasure pushed me, if nothing else, to prove her wrong. I'll tell you, boy, God certainly kept me in his sight line. I couldn't have dreamed up a script more compelling than the one that played out for me during those years. Who just happens to be approached on the street by a total stranger, only to have that man propose modeling, only to have that modeling work become a footbridge to the stage. To some, this might look like happenstance, a sequence of coincidences, a string of disconnected flukes. As I see it, my tide shift, my sharp turnaround, had the Savior's handprints all over it. His sovereignty was apparent to me. It still is. The same master who holds the firmaments in the crease of his palms, who commands oceans to recede, who maintains humanity's entire existence with the mist of his breath. That God, the source of time itself, the creator of all life, has forever been directing mine. 10. Center stage. It's not every day you find yourself seated next to Marilyn Monroe. Such a day arrived for me in 1956, not long after I'd devoted myself to acting. By then, the Spectrum had become an afterthought. Once Warren's coffers had run dry halfway through filming, he never could replenish them, even once he'd left skid marks all over Manhattan trying to raise capital. Rather than simmering in that setback, he linked arms with director Harold Young and screenplay writer Charles Gossett for Carib Gold, a maritime movie about a shrimp boat crew that discovers a sunken treasure. Diana Sands, who'd become a dear sister friend to me, was cast in the film. So was I, though not as the lead. I was to play Dottie, wife of a deckhand. Perhaps strangely to some, I felt relieved not to play the principal role. With my career still in its infancy, my preparation had yet to catch up with my passion. By the time Warren connected with Harold and Charles about the script, the inimitable Ethel Waters, the 1920s blues singer who by that time had begun lending her artistic deftness to the stage, had already been tapped as Carib's headliner. "Do you even want to be in the film?" Warren had asked me, having observed my periodic vacillations between euphoria to be in the industry and murmuring about how ruefully ill-prepared I felt. I shrugged. During one particularly low valley, I'd even threatened to go back to the Red Cross. What stopped me was the stubbornness passed on to me from a certain Frederica Theodosia Huggins, the woman I was set on rebutting. "Well, what do you want?" Warren pressed, aggravation in his tone. "I want to learn what it's all about," I said, sighing. "I don't know what I'm doing, Warren. I don't understand it. I need to study." Thus began my months-long quest for formal training. Warren persisted in his belief that my innate gifts would be enough to carry me, that the well of emotions stored up during my childhood, formed by my wail amid strife in my family's East Side home, shaped when I witnessed my mother up for auction on a Bronx sidewalk, was all the training necessary for me to infuse my portrayals with authenticity. It wasn't. Trauma may give rise to intense feeling, but to refine one's artistry, an actor must be taught to channel the unbridled rawness of that emotion, to effectively use it in service of a character's every groan and grimace. Rather than placing me in a course for total beginners, Warren instead sent me to a downtown studio for actors with some experience, albeit limited. The course gave me a migraine. I'd sit in class wondering, what are these people talking about? How do they know how to gesture, whether to speak, when to emote? I couldn't grasp it. I don't remember the instructor's name, but I do recall becoming friendly with his wife. "You know," I told her after class one day, "I really don't like this." "Why not?" she asked. "What's the matter?" "Because I don't understand what's happening," I said. "I need someone to explain this whole thing to me." "Don't worry," she said, smiling. "It'll come." It didn't, even after I'd stayed on for several more classes. She and Warren kept claiming, counterintuitively to me, that I was lost because I had too much skill. "The problem is that you're so far ahead of your classmates. There's nothing there for you to learn," Warren said. That assertion made no sense to me. As far as I could see, I had plenty to learn, whether or not he acknowledged it. The next experience was significantly better, but still no bullseye. Warren connected me with Miriam Goldina, the Russian-born stage actress and drama coach who'd studied under Konstantin Stanislavsky, the grandfather of method acting, a technique requiring a performer's full immersion in the emotional realities of the character to be portrayed. Miriam taught me some tangibles. For one thing, she made me acutely aware of the importance of words, how to listen closely to them, how to read the spaces between them, how to become cognizant of the intent behind each. When you're in conversation with someone, why might that person be saying what he or she is saying? What is that person trying to elicit from you? We examined those questions and many others, making me conscious of how critical it is for an artist to do more listening than speaking, a skill I'd been unknowingly practicing since my earliest years. What Miriam and I did not explore was what she likely assumed I already possessed, the fundamentals of acting, Theater 101. More than anything during that time, I craved a foundation. That is exactly what I told Lee Strasberg on the day I enrolled at the Actor Studio, then the most prestigious theatrical collective in the nation. Lee, who had refined and further developed Stanislavski's approach to method acting and introduced it to the West, was training greats such as Anne Bancroft and Jane Fonda. Surely he could guide me through my labyrinth of confusion and give me the basics. "Please," I begged him, "I don't want to be put in a class with professionals. I want to start from the beginning." Lee nodded as if he agreed, but he apparently took Warren's word over mine and placed me with the pros. That's how I ended up an elbow's length away from the blonde and beguiling Marilyn Monroe, then fresh off her run in the blockbuster romantic comedy The 7-Year Itch. I, too, had an itch, an instinct to flee the second I spotted her. "Lord in heaven, what am I doing here?" "Hello," she purred in my direction. That was my first time in class with Marilyn. It was also my last. I huffed my way out of there and over to Warren's office. "When I tell you I want to start at the bottom," I said, "I mean the very bottom, not in a class with a big star." Warren, as amused by my tantrums as he was accustomed to them, just laughed. "Well, all right, Cicely," he said. "Maybe it's time I send you over to Lloyd Richards." I knew the name. Diana had mentioned the distinguished acting coach to me on several occasions, most notably when I'd fallen into one of my steepest stupors about my inexperience. I'd uttered another empty threat that evening. I was one melancholic episode away from returning to my day job. "You know, you really should go down to Paul Mann Actors Workshop," Diana had told me. "Lloyd Richards, Paul's business partner there, is supposed to be one of the best. Try it. And if after you go, you find that you still can't make sense of this business, then you can quit. But please give yourself a chance." Paul, an accomplished theater actor who'd founded the workshop in 1953, was Caucasian. Lloyd, a renowned African-American actor and director who years later went on to serve as dean of the Yale School of Drama, had created a nurturing environment for Black artists. Sidney Poitier had studied with Lloyd, so had Harry Belafonte, Ruby Dee, and Billy Dee Williams. That was resume enough to get me across the threshold to the school. My initial appointment was with Paul, whose introductory course was required for incoming students. Our meeting began as such encounters do, with handshakes and smiles and niceties. It ended traumatically. "So, Cicely," he said after we'd been chatting for a few moments, "where do you see yourself going in this industry?" As I thought about his